What was my most recent announcement? Right, the statistics for the test. And did you notice that my other section kicked your ass on this first exam? I don't say that to make you feel bad, but just if you want to make it a rivalry, hopefully you can come back and beat them next time. Actually, though, you as a class were almost exactly what it usually is. The grand mean for all the years I've taught it is almost exactly what your mean was. They just happen to be well above the mean. But another thing I wanted to say about that, speaking of means, is that this is usually the easiest of the five tests. So the means almost always go down in units two and three. They usually then come back up a little bit, but not because four and five are easier. It's just that by then, enough the people that dropped were the ones that got the low scores that brought it down originally. But was it about what you expected coming into the test? Okay, good. So no huge surprise. Well, let's talk about today's stuff. There's two kind of unrelated things you're doing today, one of which doesn't take nearly as long. So I'll just mention that so that I don't forget it. You're doing some pH measuring. There are duplicate trays over there. It doesn't matter which one you use. But this is pretty straightforward. You're just using pH strips and droplets of these things to test them. So the things that you have to test pH for are all over here already. It's not any of the things that you have sitting at your table. Those are for the other part of the experiment, which will take more of the time. What we're doing today is a set of tests that can tell you whether or not certain kinds of molecules are in a solution, which is a basic thing that's valuable in science. You're often working with solutions. Sometimes you don't know what you have in the solution, and it's valuable to know whether you have something or not. How many types of tests are there today? There's three different ones. There's all kinds of other tests as well, but for this course we're doing three. And what are the names? You remember the names? Benedict's test is one, the IKI test, and the Bayouret test, yes. IKI, by the way, is actually a chemical formula, not just an acronym. It stands for iodine potassium iodide, which is what's in the solution that you use in the test. What does the reason K, by the way, is potassium is because another name for it is kalium, which is what the K actually stands for. But anyway, what is the IKI test testing for? Presence of what? Specifically starch, yes. IKI is the starch test. And as we learned upstairs today, starch is a polysaccharide. And so starch is made out of glucose, as I was saying upstairs. But IKI won't detect individual glucoses. It will detect them only if they're connected together in a starch molecule. What does the Bayouret test for? Proteins. And by the way, all of these tests rely on some sort of obvious change, which is why they work as tests. A change that we can easily detect. So it's a color change in the case of Bayouret test. It turns what color? If it's positive. Violet, yes. And the IKI test turns very dark, almost black looking, if it's a strong positive. Those two of the three are pretty straightforward, so I'm just going to let you as groups obey the instructions and work through them. Of course, if you have questions, ask me, but it's pretty straightforward. The only one I really want to talk a little bit more about is the Benedict's test, which uses Benedict's solution. And that's the blue stuff back here. I just want to let you know how to use this thing. The thing that's on this jar is called a repipetter. It's really just a pump, but it's not like a shampoo pump that you push down to start. Don't mess with this, by the way. It's set as at 2. Keep it at 2. But when you first put your tube under the nozzle, which is important, just pull this whole white barrel all the way up until it stops, and then gently push it down all the way, and that will deliver exactly 2 milliliters. Anyway, the Benedict's solution, which is that blue solution, is an aqueous solution, so it's mostly water, but it contains copper ions. More about that in a minute, but I want to give you an important set of definitions, not only because it's pertinent to the Benedict's test, but because we're going to keep talking about it more and more, especially in Unit 3. And the definitions I'm talking about are for reduction and oxidation, or reduction slash oxidation, which has been, those have been combined in a into a portmanteau, which is a word made out of two other words, like spork. We call this for short redox. It's not only easier to pronounce redox than reduction oxidation, easier to say, but it's nice actually that they formed it into one word, because it reminds you of an important fact, which is you can't have one of these two processes without also having the other. Either neither of them happens or they both happen. Can't have reduction without oxidation, can't have oxidation without reduction. And that should make sense based on the definitions. But there's a little bit of confusion with the terminology for some people when first learning this, because in everyday language, when we use the word reduce, we're talking about losing something, right? Like weight reduction, for instance. But in chemistry, reduction is the gain of electrons, one or more. So if something gains electrons, it is becoming reduced. Now, the reason that still makes sense linguistically is because electrons are negatively charged particles, right? So if something gains electrons, you're adding a negative one for each of those electrons that gets added to it. And therefore, the overall charge gets reduced, right? Think of it that way to make sense of it. Exactly the opposite is oxidation. Oxidation is the loss of electrons. And since electrons don't just pop into existence or get destroyed, in other words, they have to come from somewhere and they have to go to somewhere when they're lost, that's why you can't have one of these without the other. In any redox reaction, something is becoming reduced and something else is becoming oxidized. But it's always the thing that's receiving the electrons that's becoming reduced. And it's always the thing that's losing electrons that's becoming oxidized. If you have all that straight, it can also be confusing that there are these related terms. In any redox reaction, the thing that is becoming reduced is called the oxidizing agent. Because if it is becoming reduced itself, it's receiving the electrons, that means it's causing something else to lose electrons. That's why it's called the oxidizing agent. It oxidizes something else by becoming reduced itself. And conversely, the thing that is becoming oxidized is called the reducing agent. Now, I mention that not only because it's important in its own right, but because monosaccharides are called reducing sugars. Because they're sugars, of course, but also because they can be reducing agents. That means what happens to them if they are reducing sugars? They become oxidized, right? Something else becomes reduced. Well, this is the basis of the Benedict's test. I said that it's an aqueous solution of copper ions, specifically of copper 2 ions, which is Cu with the 2 plus superscript. We've talked about ions before, but not as extensively as is necessary to explain this. In these first two groups, which are the ones we discussed, really, or at least the first group, all of the elements in the first group form an ion by losing exactly one electron. So there's only one way they form ions. All the ones in group 2 lose exactly 2 electrons. So they all make an electron just in one way. But these metals that are in this region, between the edge, right and left edges, are collectively called transition elements. And many, not all, but many of these metals in this region can form ions in more than one way. In other words, by losing a different number of ions compared to a different version of the same element's ion. Copper is one of those examples. Copper's right here. Copper 2 ion, how would you make that out of a copper atom? What has to happen to make a copper 2 ion? Two electrons get lost, right? Yeah, so now you have still the same number of positive protons, but two fewer negative electrons than there are protons, and so the overall charge is positive 2. If all you have in solution are copper 2 ions, that makes the solution to our eyes look blue. Which is why that stuff is blue, before you put any unknown thing into it. Okay, now, monosaccharides is what Benedict's test tests for. Not just any sugars, specifically monosaccharides only. Okay? Today upstairs I told you that any given monosaccharide can exist in either linear or ringed form, which you see again on the middle of page 48. And I said that if it's a monosaccharide by itself, it's not hooked to anything else, it can flip back and forth between ringed and linear form many times per second. Notice that in the linear form, which is what you built an example of, there is a carbonyl group, right? Which is why monosaccharides are either ketones or aldehydes, right? Because there's a carbonyl group. But when you wrap the carbon skeleton around on itself to form the ring structure, think about it in ball and stick models. You couldn't do that unless you have an empty hole, right, to complete the circle. Which means you need to break that double bond, turn it into a single bond. So it's the same stuff in the ring form, but it's no longer a carbonyl-containing compound. All right? And this is important because, as we were talking about today, if you build a bigger sugar, a disaccharide or bigger, by hooking together monosaccharides, those constituent monosaccharides to form glycosidic linkage between them have to be in the ringed form, like they were in that slide today. And this is why Benedict's test does not detect disaccharides or trisaccharides or polysaccharides, because all of those are locked into the ring position to be hooked together. The reason that only the linear form, which will be found only in a monosaccharide by itself, is able to be detected by Benedict's solution is because the double bond that's in that carbonyl group, which is, in terms of particles, is 4 shared electrons, right? That's an easy source of electrons to be lost from that sugar. This is why they're called reducing sugars. By losing an electron from that double bond of the carbonyl, which it'll have only if they're unattached monosaccharides in the linear form, it is in the case of Benedict's test, carbon that gets reduced. Carbon receives the electron that's lost from the sugar, from that double bond. And what happens when you add an electron to copper 2 plus? What's it turn it into? Copper 1, exactly. And this is why reduction makes sense. You've turned it from copper 2 to copper 1. The charge is reduced mathematically. So think of it that way. Well, the reason this works for a test is that if you have a solution that's nothing but copper 1 ions, it won't be blue at all. It will be brick red to our eyes, which is real obvious if you're not colorblind. And that's the basis of these tests in general. It's really a yes or no question. Yes, that particular stuff is there, or no, it's not. And so you have really no idea. If it's a positive, you really have no idea how many molecules or particles there are. So it's not a quantitative test, which is how you would get a measurement with numbers. But it can be used as a qualitative test, more than just roughly yes or no, especially Benedict's test. Because if you have a solution that has some monosaccharides in it, but really not all that many, and you put it into Benedict's solution, some of those copper 2 ions will be reduced into copper 1, but not all of them. And you'll have a mixture of copper 2s and copper 1s. And it will be no longer blue, but it won't be fully red either. It can go to green, to yellow, and eventually to red. So, yes, you get either a positive or a negative, but if it's a positive, it can be a weak positive or a strong positive. It can tell you, that way, even without putting any numbers to it, you can compare two solutions, both of which are positive, and tell which one has more of the monosaccharide. And by the way, it doesn't tell you at all what kind of monosaccharide. Any monosaccharide will cause the same result. All right, that's the background for the test. Now, how you proceed on this is that you need to do a little practice, preliminary work, so that you have a really good idea of what a true negative looks like and what a strong positive looks like. And therefore, you don't use things that you don't know the identity of to get those preliminary results. You use known substances, which are the ones that you have in your white baskets. Those are labeled what they are, so you know what they are. And the idea here is that for each of these three tests, you should choose a substance that you know does not have any of what that test tests for, so that you can get what should be a true negative, right? And look at what a true negative looks like. And then you do the same test with something you know has that substance that it tests for, so you can tell what a strong positive looks like. And then you just do any other substance for that test of your choice from the white basket. So three substances, a negative, a positive, and something else for each of the three tests. So that's 9 tests that you do right there, right? But those are all knowing what you have to work with going into it. Once you have that experience and know what the negatives and positives look like, then you go to testing on unknown solutions, which are these ones up here. And so when you use these unknowns, don't keep them at your table. There's not enough for everyone. So keep them long enough for you to deliver them to your tubes, but then put them back. Notice, though, that there's 3 letters, A, B, and C, and there's 4 of each letter, A1 through 4, B1 through 4, C1 through 4. It doesn't matter at all which numeral you choose, but you need to choose an A, a B, and a C. And make sure you write down which one you have, A2 versus A3 or whatever. Doesn't matter which one of the A's you get, though. Right? They're all different. That's why you choose one. And before you use them, no matter which one it is, just gently invert it a few times. Don't shake the hell out of it, but just do this a few times to get better results. The idea here is each of these three unknowns that you use, an A, a B, and a C, you need to subject to all three tests. In other words, you need to check A for protein using Biuret, you need to check it for monosaccharides using Benedict's, and you need to check it for starch using IKI. And then the same for the B and the same for the C. So that's nine more tests that you have to perform. Is that all clear? Now, you're not totally blind as to what these are. There's a table on whatever page. What is that page? 55. Table on 55 tells you what the possibilities are for A, B, and C. And so the idea here is to use the results of your three tests to try to deduce from that list which of those it could possibly be. And I have the answers. I don't have them memorized, but I can look them up on the other side of the door. So tell me which A you have and what your guess is, which B you have and what your guess is, and so on. I'll tell you whether you're right. All clear? Work as an entire table. Talk it out, as usual. And if you guys want to get, it's up to you. You can work as two or as four. You can get together, whatever. But it's important to work as a group. While you're doing that, I'm going to upload stuff and grade the quizzes. So if I don't see you, let me know you're wanting me.